I'm just going across the street.
Drag your mask.
Oh, no. What'd I do?
Turn around. Put your hands behind your back. Let's go.
The jury of your peers having found you guilty. 10 years.
What?
Come on. Get in that cell.
I was in jail, too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice. That's what you find. Just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
Good morning, and welcome to Crossroads. This is our regular time every Tuesday morning. The first of the month, we come to you live from the world-famous Ben's Chili Bowl on U Street in Northwest Washington, D.C. We do a two-hour show the first Tuesday of each month. And we have an interesting format for you, as usual. In the first hour, we'll be dealing with drugs and the fentanyl overdoses in D.C. and across the country with a distinguished doctor, Dr. Edwin Chapman, the internal and addiction medicine specialist. But also, we'll be talking to a gentleman who is a traumaologist. That's the first time I heard of that, somebody who specializes and working with people with trauma, especially at-risk youth and men and women coming out of institutions. So to start our program off, we've opened up with what we call the grapevine, information that you can use. The grapevine. Come on with it, Marvin. Good morning. Mid-South native Alice Marie Johnson appointed as President Trump's pardon czar. This is an interesting development. Alice Johnson was on our show two, three times in 2020 before President Trump pardoned her. She was a young lady that you saw running down the street, jumping into a white van. She did 22 years. She did 22 years for a drug conspiracy. And she got a pardon. She's been off for 4 years, and Trump appointed her as a pardon czar, which means that she makes recommendations directly to the president. She spent more than 20 years in prison for drug-related charges. She received a full pardon from President Trump in 2020. Now, she received executive clemency in 2020 and just got a pardon recently. And she went right to work. Alice Marie Johnson is a young lady who, like I said, did 27 years inside of institution, and she's been working since she's been out with the Republican administration with Trump. And she's been asked, how do you justify working with President Trump with all the polarization in the black community turning against Trump based on what he's doing now? And she said, and I quote, I'm not looking to the right and I'm not looking to the left. I'm looking to those who need help in our communities and our communities that need to be rebuilt. This is what Alice Marie Johnson said. Thank you, young lady, and I'm glad you're in that position because I know you. We've been in touch through the years. You're doing some good things, and hopefully we can bring some of our people home. How the U.S. turned away from the death penalty and toward death by incarceration. The number of people in prison for life continues to climb, even as the overall prison population declines. Here we go. Every few years, the Citizen Project looks at exactly who is serving life without parole, life and what the group terms virtual life. What researchers deem sentences so lengthy, the prisoner would likely die behind bars. Use of the death penalty has declined drastically in the U.S., but that alone does not explain the growth of life and life without parole sentencing. This is like a slow death sentence. People convicted of homicides represented about 56% of the population serving life without parole as of 2024. But a significant portion of those serving death by incarceration sentences were convicted of offenses such as robbery, burglary, or drug crimes under habitual offender laws in many states. Data shows that half of all people serving life sentences are Black, and people sentenced to life without parole experience the most significant and racial disparities you can imagine. What will Trump's executive order on private prisons really do? The order reverses Biden's ban on private prisons contracts with the Justice Department. Private immigrant detention centers never stop and is expected to grow. A On the first day of his second presidency, Donald Trump reversed former President Joe Biden's executive order on private prisons. Biden's order had barred contracts between the Department of Justice and private detention centers. When Biden issued the order in 2021, only about 14,000 federal prisoners were in private facilities, a fraction of the nearly 152,000 federal prisoners. Lauren Books, senior director of the Justice Program at Progressive Think Tank, and the think tank for the Brenner Center for Justice, said because many federal facilities are facing deteriorating infrastructure and insufficient funds to fix buildings, a small portion of the population may be moved to private facilities. Traditionally, the population that was held in custody by for-profit firms tended to be those convicted of federal crimes who are undocumented. She said that is because undocumented prisoners, many of whom will be deported after incarceration. And that is something to look at. Fear for their lives. Trans women, federal prisoners told they will be housed with men. After a minor change in the judge's order, the Trump administration arranged to move over a dozen transgender women to men facilities. Folks, that is trouble on top of trouble on top of trouble. In 2022, after years of legal battles, Donald Langham became the first federal prisoner ever to receive gender confirmation surgery. Her listing in the Bureau of Prisons director says female. Yet earlier this week, she was notified that the federal prison system was moving her to a male facility. According to several sources familiar with the situation, more than a dozen other transgender women in federal prisons received word this week that they too will be moved into men's prisons. Last month, President Trump issued an executive order that, among other provisions, barred trans women from being housed in women's prisons. After three trans prisoners sued, arguing that the order was discriminatory and cruel and unjust, unusual punishment, a judge prevented them from being moved, but the Bureau began making arrangements to transfer other transgender people. A case in point, people, this is trouble. If them young ladies were transgender, they started their physical change in terms of their breasts and their body, and said, putting them in the men's prison is asking for, you are massacring them. Don't do it. Don't put them in the, put them in a separate facility. If you don't want them with the women, you don't want them with the men, put them in a separate facility. If you send these transgenders to a male prison, folk, you might as well execute them, because that's a no-no. That's all I can say about that. And lastly, I want to say thank you for all the people who showed up last Friday at the book signing with Tyrone Parker and over at this church in Studio W in Southeast Washington. It was a beautiful evening, and thank you all. And also, we have something that's jumping off tonight. President Trump is giving this a speech. He's addressing Congress tonight. But on this evening, the Congressional Black Caucus and members of civil rights activists, organizations, voting rights advocates, labor leaders, business leaders, grassroots activists, we will not carry Donald Trump's speech. Instead, when Trump walks to the mic, they will go live to New Haven, Connecticut, where Reverend William J. Barber will deliver our speech from our perspective. My team will show clips of the twice impeached criminally convicted felon in chief, and we'll discuss these matters after Barber is done. Spread the word. To keep Trump ratings low, do not watch any news network. I would love to have 100,000 plus watching us live on youtube.com/Roland S. Martin or on the Black Star Network. Again, please help spread the word by sharing this with your network, family, friends, church, neighbors, co-workers. We need everybody to participate to show that we got some solidarity. And that's been what we call the grapevine, information that you can use. The grapevine. Thank you. Thank you. Now we get to our first guest this morning is Dr. Edwin Chapman. He's a good friend. In fact, I've never been so close to a doctor, and I wouldn't get no medication or treatment. This guy and I talk 3-4 times a week. He's all over the city. He's concerned about what's going on with the drug and the fentanyl overdoses in D.C., what's happening at the D.C. jail and how these the residents are being treated or not being treated, and why we need emergency, immediate assistance to deal with those folk in recovery. Those people coming out of hospitals from Medicaid and Medicare who cannot be readmitted to the hospital, because we need respite housing. We need emergency housing. We need emergency services. You got a crisis on top of a crisis that's going into another crisis. So we're having Dr. Edwin Chapin. Is he available?
Yes, he's online.
Good morning, Dr. Chapin. Are you there?
Good morning, Roach.
Oh, look at you. You got on my sweater, man.
Oh, we did not coordinate this.
How you doing, Doc?
I'm doing great. Doing great.
Doc has been in this town for over 40-some years working. He's been on Benning Road over there. I mean, in his office there is packed, jammed, folk inside and out. And this is one of the few doctors or medical personnel that we've met who can't sleep at night. He sends out emails 3, 4, 5. Do you sleep, man? You send out email 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning about the drug crisis. What's your take, Dr. Chapman, on what's going on with the drug overdose and the fentanyl situation in Washington, D.C., sir?
So Roach, you know, you've been way ahead of the curve in all of this for years. And as a medical doctor, you know, our approach has always been through the healthcare line. But it's only been recently that we've actually focused on other issues, particularly the so-called social determinants of health. But I've heard you give talks on the steps of City Hall about returning citizens and the importance of having housing, food, jobs, et cetera. So when we put all this together, we really realized that there's more to healthcare than just medication. And having a roof over your head is medicine. And that's why I think we've had such a meeting of the mind, so to speak, in the fact that we provide complementary services. And your approach from the community, emphasizing the importance of community involvement. Let me just give you an example. 2 years ago, there were 250 inmates in the DC jail on medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. Generally, buprenorphine or Suboxone and methadone. Today, there are 500. Do you hear what I said? There are 500. The number
in the DC jail currently right now.
Right now, there are 500 inmates on either buprenorphine or methadone. The problem is, what happens when they're discharged? They lose their health insurance, their Medicaid, when they go in jail, and it takes up to a month to get it turned back on. Can you imagine somebody coming out of jail with no job, no place to stay, and no health insurance? What's going to happen? You're going to have recidivism. You're going to have people go right back in. So it's a setup. And so what we've been working on with you is the fact that we have to have housing. We have to have community involvement, but we have to have activism. And if the community is silent, we're going to see those numbers grow. And that's a tremendous concern. Most of these folks are under 40. And we actually went into the DC jail 2 years ago, and just a month ago, one of those young men that was in there 2 years ago came to my office in just that situation. So we know this is real, that if we don't take care of our own, then we're going to see people continue to go back in and repeat the same thing, not by their fault, but by our fault.
You mentioned something, Doctor, about folks being released, like from the hospital. And I understand that these folks are being released after surgery, after a week or 2 weeks, and they're thrown back onto the street, and they need some kind of respite or short-term or mild convalescence. That's non-existent. I understand that Medicare or Medicaid has cut that out, that if somebody gets surgery and they're discharged, they cannot be readmitted for that same illness until 30 days has passed. And where do they go in the meantime while they're waiting to be readmitted? Even if they left a sponge inside of the surgery, you still cannot come back in. You can come back into the hospital for a new illness, for a new admission, but not for the one you just received the surgery for. And this is compounding the problem that you are facing, Doc. or we in the community, that these folk are just dumped right on the street with nowhere to go. As you said, we went to the city council a couple of years ago, stepped on the mayor's, stepped to the mayor's building. Last week we went to and met with the chairman of the city council. And all we get is lip service. Jiggy boogie, you're going to do this, they're going to do that. And people are dying. A week don't go by, doctor, you don't tell me this, where your office is located in Washington. Folks are living all around the side of it. It's hanging out there, sleeping on the streets. They ain't got nowhere to go. And here you are trying to do whatever you can to provide patient care. And these folks are being ignored, disregarded. And what can we do, doc, right now? What can we do, the listening audience? Is there anything that we can do to help deal with this drug overdose, fentanyl crisis in the streets and in the D.C. jail?
Yeah, so, Roach, you actually identified another group of patients, generally people who are 65, 70 years old. 12% of our senior citizens have no family. They have no family support. So, again, that's another group with chronic diseases like diabetes, hypertension, that go to the hospital and come out that need community support. So we've been working with a network of churches called the Leadership Council for Healthy Communities. We really have to force the city to give us the type of housing that we need, that the community can actually take care of people as you described it. Some people would call that respite housing, but it's temporary housing for people who have had an acute problem and just need support in the community to help get their medicine, to help get their food. And we as a community can actually take care of each other. But you have to have the facilities to do that. There's plenty of vacant housing in this city. And in many instances, people will get vouchers and go months to years before they can exercise that. But this model, what we're talking about, having the community support actually saves money. And it, just as you described, if they don't go back to the hospital in those first 30 days, that saves Medicare money. If somebody is supported in the community and does not go back to jail, that saves money. Both in the criminal justice system as well as in the medical system. So those are the types of savings that we're talking about. We can save money to make money.
Was there anything in the mayor's budget for addiction services to help people overcome addiction by increasing access to services? Was there anything in the mayor's recent budget that would deal with increasing the services for addiction recovery?
So I'm going to have to be honest with you. I have not listened to the read the mayor's budget, so I can't comment on that.
Okay. Well, I know the way things have been going, I wouldn't be surprised if it hasn't, because everything else has been cut and sliced. I'd like to ask you this, doctor. The drug policy. How is the drug policy impacting you? Because you talk about buprenorphine and getting these folks and the dosage increase. How has this impacted the overdose death in D.C.? And is fentanyl the main cause or contributing factor to people dying in the streets from overdoses?
Yes. So fentanyl, for the past 10 years, we went from 20% fentanyl in 2015 to 96% fentanyl in 2023. We went from 83 deaths, if you can imagine, in 2014 to 522 deaths in 2023. There has been a decrease in many places across the country in 2024. And there are multiple factors involved in that. But certainly in our community, because of the fentanyl, there's been a disproportionate impact on our patients who were generally older and previously exposed to heroin, now seeing nothing but fentanyl. So we've lost a lot of older patients. Our concern now is with the increase in the jail, and the jail is not at fault. the fact is they're doing a good job in the DC jail. The problem is what happens when they come out. And the other issue is, why aren't they getting the treatment that they need before they have to commit a crime to get in jail so they can get treatment? That's where the problem is.
You know, you mentioned previously that there's over 500 inmates over at the DC jail who are on medication for substance abuse violation. What's being done? Are they getting the right doses, medication, or how are they being treated or serviced? Is that something we need to be concerned about?
They're getting the right medication. They're getting the right medication, but they need to be connected to services when they come out of jail. And those services include not only the medication, but also the other social supports, so-called social determinants of health that we mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So while overdose deaths are down overall, rates remain high or increase among Black and Latino population and Native American. Why is that? Overdose deaths are down. Why is it increasing amongst the minorities and Blacks and Spanish and Native Americans? Why is that increasing?
It's based on the fact that we've actually had two different epidemics. The so-called white epidemic was generally started by pills from the hospital and the doctor's office. The Black and Hispanic epidemic was primarily street drugs, heroin to fentanyl, and then other drugs like cocaine that have been infiltrated with fentanyl when people don't know that. Or you have young people buying medications on the internet that have been laced with fentanyl and that they are not aware of. So it's a very different epidemic in our community.
You know, you called me a couple of days ago, doctor, about an emergency, about a young man, you said, who got a job, he got released. He was in the street with nowhere to go, and he was just lost, and we were trying to find him someplace. What's the status of that? You want to give us a little rundown of that situation, please?
So we finally did, were able to track him down. He actually sent me a text message Monday morning that was very upsetting because he was stable on his buprenorphine. He's not using drugs, but he had no place to, he was living on the street and had no food. And so we connected him to one of our peer support persons who actually works with us through the Leadership Council for Healthy Communities. And that's another aspect of people who have been through incarceration, have been through drug treatment, are the best people to actually guide someone who's new to this out of trouble. And so we really want to be able to spread that concept, the concept of peer support in the community.
Okay. If somebody's seeking help with drug use, they face what kind of obstacles to support? If somebody want to get off of drugs, and where did they go? How did they get off? Or how did they? What kind of support can you get? If somebody says, "I had enough, get me off." What did they do?
So again, housing is key, regardless of the circumstances. Once you have a person safely housed, then you can triage them and find out what their other problems are, whether they have mental health problems, whether they have economic problems, whether they have family support. But you need to have that person in a stable environment. And I'm not talking about a shelter, you know, a place where you go in at night and leave in the morning. We're talking about having stable housing, regardless of that person's ability to pay.
Please leave your message.
Yeah. Oh, and, that's interesting. One of the things that I'm concerned with, Doc, and you're concerned with, is housing. You and another Dr. Waldo and I went over and looked at an apartment building over in Northeast by the National Arboretum. And it's a beautiful building. It's 17 bedrooms and it's 17 baths. And we all liked it, but we went and spoke to the chairman of the city council, Mr. Mendelson, to see if we can get some resources to acquire this building to make it available for those folks coming out for short-term respite care from hospitals, for addicts in various stages of recovery, and a transitional home. But we've been running into obstacles upon obstacles, and it's extremely frustrated. And I don't know how you stay on the front line like this, Doc, because I know when I heard you explain the situation, it gets me frustrated, and there's nothing we can do. But I know, and you know, that we meet periodically with the members of CRUZ and other organizations, and you made all the meetings. I've never seen a physician attend all these community meetings. You be there more than I do, man. And I thought I was on the front line, but you on the front line in front of the front line, and you're risking your life. What is it, man, that we need to do? Who can we reach? Because I am tired. You are tired. We know we need resources, and we can't get it. And we see people dying every day. People come to your office crying with no place to go, nowhere to sleep, no job, nothing to eat. And we call the government, and they tell us, we'll get back with you next week. But this person is hurting right now. And if we don't address that immediate concern, we're going to lose another life. This is extremely frustrating to feel that we're talking about getting rid of this problem. Has it reached out youngsters yet? How many youngsters have you noticed, Doc, in your practice that's been experimenting with fentanyl and opiates?
So over the past 10 years, I've treated over 1,100 patients in my office that have been exposed to fentanyl. So we've lost a number of patients. As you know, it took us 10 years to get the FDA to change the dose of buprenorphine. The Howard University College of Pharmacy faculty and students actually reviewed my charts, and we wrote two papers that were published, one in 2017 and one in 2019, that showed that higher doses of buprenorphine were needed to treat these patients. On December 26, 2024, the FDA finally put out a press release acknowledging that fact. So they've asked all of the drug companies that make buprenorphine or Suboxone to change the labeling so that patients can get doses above 24 milligrams without a prior authorization. That's a critical point. But the fact that it was Howard University College of Pharmacy that made that possible, those are the kinds of secrets, that's the kind of information, so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion that Trump is trying to stamp out. We knew it because we were here seeing it firsthand in the District of Columbia and published it. So again, we have to reject ignorance. And we're obviously seeing a lot of misinformation and ignorance from the highest authorities in this country. And I'm willing to say it. I learned from the best. I was very fortunate to go to Howard University at the time that I went. And you would be surprised. We had the first Black board certified neurosurgeon, Dr. Jesse Barber, actually was one of the founders of Housing for the Homeless, which became Unity Health Clinic. Paul Cornelli Sr. was a pioneer in public health. So Dr. Elise Galati, who was a psychiatrist,
dynamic lady,
go out
dynamic
in the streets and look for her patients. So we were taught that there was no separation in taking care of human beings based on their economics, that this was our responsibility as physicians. So what has happened in the meantime, I'm not really sure, but I know that I'm not going back. I learned from the best.
Doc, let me ask you this. We're on radio right now, and it's going all around the world. What is it, if you had an opportunity to sit down and talk to the mayor, to explain the urgency and the sensitivity of this particular issue about drugs, drug overdose, and et cetera, what would you say to the mayor if she was right there in front of you?
Well, I think Donald Trump just told her that he wants the homeless folks, he wants the homeless folks off the street. Now, where are you going to put them? Are you going to put them in jail? Are you going to put them in hotels? But he wants them off the street. So that's one thing that we agree on, is that the homeless need to have a roof over their head and food. We should treat the homeless are human beings, but we treat stray dogs and cats better than we do human beings in this country.
You know, this is WPFW 89.3 FM on your radio dial. PFW's Crossroads is broadcast on WPFW, and we come to you every Tuesday. And for the first Tuesday, we come live from the world-famous Ben's Chili Bowl, where we are right now. We wanted to invite the doc down, but he had to see his patients. We had two hot dogs and a half smoke for you this morning for breakfast, but you weren't able to make it. So I want to thank you for jumping in. But, Doc, you and I have been fighting about this D.C. jail and Unity Health and what's going on over there. When you say it's a crisis inside of the jail, you got 500 people that's on medication, drug prevention medication inside the jail. That means they got drug problems. That means also it's connected to them being arrested or played a sizable role in there. And we haven't dealt with the root causes of this situation. And the root causes of our folk who are using narcotics and drugs, et cetera. And with Trump slashing and cutting and fine and laying people off, talking about cutting Medicare, Medicaid, talking about slashing the AID, all these federal agencies and the services they provide. This is going to increase, so impact, because on last night, some people who've been working 10, 15 years have lost their job in the federal government, and they're thinking they're talking about suicide or using drugs or getting drunk. So the increase in abuse of substances is going to be on the rise, because everybody, 10 people lose a job, one or two is going to start drinking or using drugs some kind of way, maybe more, maybe less. But the problem is they're not addressing the drug issue. They're talking about saving billions, but they're putting people in the street. They're going to even cut SNAP, the food stamp program. If you're going to lose people, five people, kick them in the street, no job, then you're going to cut the food stamps, then you're going to cut Medicaid and Medicare. What the hell do people do? Where did they go?
So, Roach, you really talked about an economic model that makes no sense. And that's why, you know, we need to tune out foolishness. One of the ways that I was able to get out of Gary, Indiana, was to ignore ignorance. And what you're describing is economic ignorance on the part of the president. I mean, it's very clear. You can't cut Medicaid and Medicare and at the same time
cut food stamps.
Cut food stamps and not have people oppressed, depressed, and taking drugs to relieve that oppression and depression. So we know better. And I think a classic example was what we saw last Friday. Is a real warrior, the president of Ukraine, showed you what a real warrior is all about. You know, they wanted to criticize him because he didn't have on a suit, but this man is fighting a war. And I think the reason why you and I hit it off so well is because you've been a warrior on the field for decades. And I always tell people, that lions and pussycats don't run together. If you're gonna run with the lions, you got to be a lion. You can't be soft.
Yes, you know that's you just said it. If you're gonna be a lion, be a lion. Is there anybody supporting what you're doing, Doc? And you getting any support? I know you can say LCHC, Leadership Council. They've been right there with us, with you, and with us. Is there anybody that's supporting what you're doing, Doc? Because this, you seem to be the only man that's peeping and seeing this issue. When I walk ride down Benny Road, I see 10 to 15 people standing right next to your office on the corner of 17th and Benny, et cetera. Who is helping you? Who can we turn to for support to deal with this overdose, fentanyl, homelessness crisis affecting our community?
Well, again, that's why I came out of the office one of my longtime patients, and this is a classic example. This gentleman had been to every federal prison from here to California. I got him 20 years ago when he was 57 years old. You know him. You've been in meetings with him. He's now 77, drug-free, and he's a spokesperson in the community. He's a mentor in the community. So I've seen what a community support can do. You mentioned the OGs. You mentioned the crews. Those are people who've been there, done that, and they're fighters. They're warriors. And I'm not as old as you are. I'll be 79
since when? This month. They told me you was 92, Doc. I mean, you ain't old as me.
So my focus is, I know my time is limited, and I don't have time to fool with people who are not serious. And so that's why we do what we do. That's why I go to those meetings, because those are real warriors. Those are people who I can trust with my life.
There you go.
And I think that's the key.
You know, you just said something that's very influential and powerful. When you come to the meetings with the OGs, with crews, the Alliance of Concerned Men, 100 Fathers, these are folks who are on the front line, and they're giving it all, and they're doing it whether they get paid or not get paid. And that's one of the sticks I use to judge how people are, because we've been doing, these guys that you mentioned, they've been doing this for 40, 50 years. A lot of them don't get paid, but because they've been through what we're talking about, drug addiction, incarceration, and that kind of stuff, they need what we're talking about. And I feel the same thing you feel. I walk into the meetings and I feel a warmth. I feel a closeness. You feel somebody, you know, they ain't there because they want some money, because if they had money, they wouldn't be at our meetings. You know, if they had it, they wouldn't be there. You know what I mean? But they're there because of concern, their commitment, and their passion to make a difference in somebody's life and try to prevent folk from going down the path that they did. And these guys and women are our true warriors or heroes on the front line. And as we always say, Doc, we got the horses, but we don't have the resources. You got the knowledge, information, experience, and expertise, and if you can't get the resources and the help, and we all coming together, mobilizing our contacts to see what we could do. I take my hat off to you, Dr. Chapman, and these other doctors who are working on doing what we're doing. And it seems like we're not making any progress. Do you think we're making any progress? What do you see?
Well, I think progress is going to be forced upon our local leadership. I'm going to be very clear. I've not gotten a lot of help from our local leadership. I just did an interview for Chinese government television. Can you believe that?
Say that again.
For Chinese government, Chinese global television network.
Yeah.
Interviewed me and one of my patients two weeks ago. They're going to put out a documentary. They know about what we're doing with fentanyl and drug treatment. Why doesn't the district government know? And I'm not bragging. I have spoken before the American Bar Association, the National Bar Association, the American Medical Association, the National Medical Association, the American Society of Addiction Medicine. But I can't get any respect from the local government. So I won't leave it there, but that should tell you something.
You know, right down the street from you, there's two brand new apartment buildings, and there's one across the street on 17th Street. But yeah, there's people laying on the side of your building in an alley and behind your building, sleeping in the alley and in dumpsters and on the ground, et cetera. And you got these three brand new buildings, apartment complexes, and these folks are in dire need of emergency housing, respite care, financial assistance, mental health counseling, and they're not getting nothing. But yet we can spend I had a list the other day that we spent over several billion giving foreign aid to Ukraine and other countries around the world. And I wonder how much is being spent when I had the top of the show, how much is being spent and what's the budget for recovering addicts or returning citizens, respite care, housing. And we already got an ungodly amount of people without homes and juveniles without homes. And now they're talking about 10, 20, 30,000 more that's being displaced or fired or terminated from the federal government. And they're going to increase our numbers. Do you see that? How do you see that impacting what you're doing when all these people are being fired, Doc? You expect to get some increase in customers
or patients? You don't have to go that far. The mayor and city council just gave a billionaire $515 million to renovate the basketball and
Ted Leonis, yes,
stadium. And as of yesterday, they said the city is perhaps $1 billion in the hole and talking about paying for a public football stadium. So you tell me.
You know, it seems like the priorities are misplaced. The folks who have it are getting more, and the people who have less are getting less than what they had it originally. So the rich are getting rich, and the poor are getting poor. And we're left in the middle, Doc, trying to save lives. It's like we're trying to be farming, and the house is on fire. The house is on fire, and we run into a house, and we don't have a fire hose. But yeah, we can put the fire out. Yeah, we can put the fire out. You know, so we need to get that kind of support stimulated. You know what I mean? Because it doesn't seem right that we're fighting fires, but we don't have no fire trucks. We ain't no fire horns. We ain't got no water. But they expect us to run in these buildings and pull these folk out and save their life, and we don't have anything. Then they can give a $500 million to the billionaires for business downtown. They can spend over $100 or $125 billion for Ukraine. They spend billions all around the world in foreign aid, but nothing here in Washington, D.C. And as you said, President Trump don't like this homelessness, so he's going to do something about it. But what I'm afraid of, he's going to lock him up. He's going to put him in jail. When he came out and said that his first day in office, Doc, the stock for the two largest private prisoners company, CoreCivic and the GEO Group, their stock went up tremendously. And because he's talking about deporting thousands of migrants, before they deport him, he got to arrest them and detain them. Then he got to feed them, sleep them, and provide care for them. So they're talking about building 130 more, talking about building 130 more institutions and prisons to house the migrants. So there are communities around the country, Doc, who are rubbing their hands and smiling. They can't wait to get these contracts to house these migrants as detainees before they shipped out of the country. So this is a multi-billion dollar industry. And Trump is talking about 130 more detention correctional facilities. This means that when you put one of these facilities in the community, it adds $200 to $300 million to that local community's economy. So migrant incarceration detention is a multi-billion dollar business. And when you throw in drug treatment, drug aftercare, there's overdoses and all these things that's related to it. This is a multi-billion dollar business. And we sit down here as little old peons trying to overthrow an elephant. That's what it's like, a peon trying to overthrow an elephant. But I like your heart and your spirit. And Doc, I don't know what we're going to do, but to keep on doing what we can do. You know what I mean? You got Dr. Wudu. He's with MedStar and in charge of the Returning Citizens Division of the MedStar. And we spoke to him. We spoke to other folks all over the city, the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, all these organizations to see what they can do to assist us. I was a drug addict, Doc. My father was a drug addict. My grandfather was a drug addict. Two of my brothers were drug addicts. So we grew up in this whole drug culture in Washington, D.C. And it didn't change from the time that we were involved in it until now. And it's more deadly. Folks are running when they say that somebody OD'd, say on 17th in Benning Road, everybody said, on what corner? And they can run around there and try to get the same, what they call the killer dope. And they don't care if they die or not. And that goes to the root causes of why people are using this. And with this economy being what it is, and they fine people, terminating relationships, closing out government agencies, cutting out food stamps, cutting out Medicaid, they're talking about Social Security. What the hell do people do? Where do they go for help?
So all politics is local. 60 years ago, I was a freshman in sociology sitting in Dr. Nathan Hare's classroom. And Dr. Nathan Hare wrote a book called The Black Anglo-Saxons. In other words, he was talking about the fact that there are black white supremacists. There are black folks that will do you in quicker than a white person. So we have to be very careful about our politicians and what their priorities are. And you mentioned that, you know, if our politicians are talking about building stadiums when our folks are sleeping on the street, that should tell you something. That's who he was talking about.
Yes.
That is the enemy within.
Yes.
Trump talked about the enemy within. I talk about the enemy within. And I'm very clear about who those individuals are. They're not teaching what I was taught in medical school by Francis Welsing, Elise Gilardi, Jesse Barber. That's where the difference is.
That's where what is? What's that you said? You said that's where what is?
That's where the difference. That's where the difference is.
Okay.
It's in your perspective and your values. They value life over money.
How is it, doctor? What is it? What's the overdose rate in Washington, D.C. right now? What's the overdose death rate?
I really don't know because mid-year last year, they changed the way they published the data. So the district actually did what Trump is trying to do by getting rid of information out of the CDC, World Health Organization, NIH. And that's skew the data so that it doesn't make any sense. But mid-year last year, the reports that were put out, I could follow the reports by age, ward, and demographic details. Now you get cumulative data that is useless as far as I'm concerned. And I think that was done on purpose.
How can we increase access to drug treatment services? What can we do? We know it wasn't in the budget. If it was, we didn't see it. And if it was, it was so small and insignificant, it didn't even make it matter. What can we do as non-government employees, as concerned citizens? What can we do to help increase drug services for those men and women and youth who are in dire need of it?
Everyone in the community has a role, and you have to identify that role. And I think that's the whole reason why we're involved in these various organizations. If you try to do what you don't know, you know, I'm not a housing expert. I'm not a legal expert. So I need to partner with people who have that expertise. I can bring the medical piece, but I cannot necessarily bring the experience that you can bring to the table. But if we all join together and work as a team, then we can make this happen without burning ourselves out. And I think that's the critical component, the fact that it has to be done as a team.
What are some of the obstacles, doctor, people facing? Somebody want to get off of drugs and they go to the hospital. What are some of the obstacles they face? Just trying to say, hey, I want to stop. Please help me. Where do I go?
Well, actually, it depends on the substance that's being abused. With opioids, we have three medications that we can use. With alcohol, there's some support medications. With tobacco, there's some replacement medications. But most drugs like cocaine, PCP, there is no replacement medication, and it's really a matter of community support, counseling, et cetera. So it varies and depends very much on the substance that's being abused.
So to the pals and beaters listening to this show, what can we say to light a fire under their back pocket to get them to get off their can and do something? What can we do to light a fire? Because we need a fire, an earthquake, a tornado, and a tsunami need to come through here to get this stuff straightened out, because people are dying as you and I sitting here talking. And a human life is precious. What can we do, or what can we, how can we inspire, motivate, or get folks to say, let's do something about this? What can we do?
Well, right now, I think we need to get key people to a one-on-one meeting with the community, and we could start with the. With the Attorney General's office. As far as I'm concerned, the Attorney General is sitting in a building with folks that stink to high heaven from a medical standpoint. And I've been very clear about that. I can smell them from 441 4th Street over here on Benning Road.
You can smell what?
I can smell a skunk. And I'm very clear about it. I've said it over and over again, it's not good medicine. And that's why we have not only the highest rate of overdoses, but we also have the highest rate of kidney failure. And that is because we have untreated hypertension and diabetes. And so we've had 15 years of bad medicine practiced in this city because of the way the money is spent. And I'm gonna be very clear. What you saw in New York in December was the tip of the iceberg. Our health insurance companies are doing just what Donald Trump is trying to do to this government. And that's rape and take every dollar they can out of the hands of the people that need it. These health insurance companies are not providing the services. Nobody is overseeing the way the money is spent based on outcomes. And that's why we're seeing the results that we're seeing. And it's happening right here in this city and has been happening for years.
You know, we got a minute or two before we get off here, Doc. What is it you want to say, a closing argument or closing statement to whomever? Because I want to, like you, I'm tired. I had enough. I want some action. I don't want no more talking, no more jiggy boogie. I don't want you to promise me nothing. What can we do to save lives? Because I know how. I looked at something the other day, knocked on Philadelphia. That thing about crank, this other drug, they look like zombies. They're standing in the street in all kinds of weird, unusual poses, and it's eating their skin up, and this drug is eating them alive. Do we have the same crank problem down here in Washington, D.C., that's hitting Philly and other cities? This drug is terrible, man.
Yeah, it's xylazine that's mixed with the fentanyl. And I've had 50 patients documented with xylazine and fentanyl in their systems. Fortunately, we haven't seen the skin ulcers. A lot of our folks are smoking it rather than shooting it. And I think that makes the difference. But again, these are very, very powerful drugs. Xylazine is an animal tranquilizer. And there's another form of fentanyl called carfentanil that's 100 times more potent than fentanyl. In 2017, I think we had 3 deaths in the district, and they had a lot of deaths in Ohio. But fortunately, we have not seen that recently. But if you get carfentanil, you're almost certainly going to die.
Well, we're about out of time, and our guest has been none other than the world famous Dr. Edwin Chapin. He's my Willie Mays, Babe Ruth on the front line, knocking the ball out the park. We need help. Dr. Chapin need help. Our community need help. And folks, please take what he told you, because we're talking about lives. Most of the folk we bring on the show are warriors. They're on the front line, and they're doing it because their commitment and their passion is there. And this man is a shining example. And whatever you need to say, whatever you need to do, Doc, all you have to do is call the Roach Man, and we'll be there to help. And I, like I said, I want you to set the fire on him this morning, light him up, and tell him, hey, we need help. We got the horses, but we don't have the resources. And we can help stop and reduce some of this foolishness with the OGs and crews and 100 followers. We got folk who can do this. And with doctor in our corner, we can attack our heroin problem or drug overdose problem, but we can't get the help. If we were millionaires and billionaires and owned apartment buildings, we can get all we want. But we're little teeny folks. So folks, please take what Dr. Chapman is saying to heart and see what you can do. Because we need all hands on deck. Thank you a lot, Dr. Edwin Chapman, for joining us to talk to discuss this crisis of drug overdoses, fentanyl. We're going to bring you back when we talk about what's going on over at the D.C. jail in terms of medical care or lack of medical treatment. So in your closing remarks, Doc, anything you want to say?
If you live in Prince George's County, vote for Calvin Hawkins. and by the way, as you look forward, you need to decide who your next mayor is going to be, because that's going to determine how money is going to be spent. Okay. Don't forget to vote.
Beautiful.
Don't forget to vote.
Yeah, don't forget to vote, Faith. The day is a day for people in PG County. You can vote for county exec in PG County. Thank you, Dr. Edwin Chapman, my good friend, my buddy. And he's the first doctor I ever hung with. Usually when I'm with a doctor, I'm getting an injection or they put me in the hospital. But you the first doctor I sit down and we had dinner and talk and laugh and crack jokes. You all right with me, man. When I get to be 95, I'm going to be just like you. Thanks all a right. lot, Dr. Chapman. We'll see you later. Thank you. This has been Crossroads with Roach Brown and my wife, Mertine. This has been the first hour of our two-hour special on the first Tuesday of each month. We'll be coming back to you in the next hour with another guest in the next few minutes on Crossroads. Stay tuned. And until he just cut us off. Tyrone is on his way.
Yeah.
Where's Nikisha?
Nikisha can't. She got to be somewhere at noon because she's...
We got the gift of beauty.